No, we can't catch a break, it seems. The harsh winter did little to lower the tick population, and ticks are showing up in robust numbers in Wisconsin, looking for a nice warm meal on us. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It is coming up on 6:37 on this Wednesday, May 14th. We will welcome your questions about preventing and treating Lyme disease at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. In our last half hour, we heard from a medical researcher on Lyme disease, that the ticks are out there in big numbers. Now we will hear from a clinician, a medical doctor. Dr. David McNamara specializes in infectious disease with Gunderson Health System. Good morning.
Hello.
Boy, the ticks are really, really out there, according to Steve Callister. So how do we contract Lyme disease?
Certainly the vector is a black-legged, or some people call them deer ticks. And if it, especially the nymphal form, but if the tick, gets on a human and attaches and is there for typically more than 36 to 48 hours, if the tick is carrying Lyme disease bacteria, it would have some risk of transmitting them to the human.
Yeah, and we did again talk about the deer tick carrying Lyme disease. Also, though, the Lone Star tick is apparently showing up in Wisconsin as well, and this carries another very similar illness. Do you anything different to find that or treat that?
We don't have as much experience with that. Typically the treatment that one would use for Lyme disease would treat that if somebody had an acute case with that. But we don't have the same type of diagnostic testing for that. But we certainly haven't seen nearly as much of that as we do Lyme disease. Yeah.
We just heard from a caller at the very end of our last half hour who is outside a lot, picks ticks off of herself a lot,
sure,
but is older and said, hey, she has joint pain all the time. How should she know if she should come in and get a test for Lyme disease?
That's a common, sort of a very common conundrum. And so making a diagnosis of Lyme disease really takes a combination of a physician evaluating the patient, taking a good history, doing a good physical exam, and then using some judicious testing. And those kind of symptoms of sort of generalized aches and pains are terribly nonspecific. And so, often somebody may think, gee, may I have Lyme disease, go to a physician, have some testing done. The testing may come back negative. It may come back positive. And interpreting the testing also takes some familiarity with the type of diagnostic testing that's being done. So it can be tough to sort that out. Certainly a lot of people with those sort of symptom complexes won't have Lyme disease, but a real wide variety of medical ailments could cause that.
Mm-hmm. Well, what symptoms should someone, be considering when they decide if they should make an appointment to see a doctor about the possibility?
So typically for Lyme disease, if somebody has acute Lyme disease, sort of the initial infection, many people with that would have what we call an erythema migrans rash, which is like a red, often it's sort of oblong or circular or oval-shaped rash.
Mm-hmm.
That's common, although, significant minority of patients with Lyme disease won't have that rash. But if you have an erythema migrans rash that's, you know, visible and diagnosed by a healthcare provider, that's diagnostic of acute Lyme disease, and we would typically treat that person right away with a short course of oral antibiotics that's extremely reliable in killing and eradicating that acute infection.
I see. So that's like where the site of the bite.
Often, yeah, and it can disseminate to other patches of skin. So sometimes we'll see people coming in with a bunch of different erythema migrans rashes spread out at different parts of the body. We can see that too. And then the other sort of manifestation, if you have Lyme disease and it's not recognized early and treated, it can certainly disseminate to a wide variety of other organs. And then people develop sort of later or more chronic manifestations of that infection. And the common things that we would see would be often people showing up weeks to months later with big, red, hot, swollen joints, typically a knee, but it can be an elbow or other large joints. That's common. And that's how the original Lyme disease cases were really recognized back in 1975 in Connecticut, was with children who were showing up with big, hot, swollen joints. And then occasionally we'll see some meningitis from Lyme disease, Bell's palsy, which is where the facial nerve has paralysis, like half the face is kind of drooping down. In this region, actually a fair amount of Bell's palsy cases are from Lyme disease. And then once in a while we'll see a meningitis, but also every year at Gunderson we have a few people who are admitted with a heart block where that Lyme disease bacteria is infecting the conduction system of the heart, and they're coming in with extremely slow heart rates.
Oh, my gosh. I had no idea that all these things could be caused by, again, this is untreated or undiagnosed Lyme disease in a more chronic state.
You bet.
Yeah. So what do you do then?
So typically, you know, the big challenge is sort of accurately making the diagnosis. The treatment is fairly straightforward. Usually we use a couple weeks of an oral pill, commonly doxycycline. For some manifestations, occasionally we'll put in an IV line and use a few weeks of an IV, like a once-daily IV antibiotic also. So those are sort of the main treatment options. But the treatment is extremely effective in curing and eradicating the bacteria.
Yeah. So once, if you come in with a more chronic state of the Lyme, a couple of weeks of either oral or even IV antibiotics is effective. When we hear of cases of people who, you know, think that they've had it for years and years, that's not usually the case if they've been treated.
If they'd been treated, the antibiotics have, you know, very high effectiveness in eradicating the organism and killing it. The problem is we know that a subset of patients with Lyme disease, after they've been successfully treated, certainly have ongoing symptoms. And that's well recognized that some people will have a lot of ongoing fatigue, achiness, headaches, that kind of thing, almost like a post-Lyme disease sort of symptom complex that's certainly well recognized. And we know that people who have Lyme disease in a joint, often it'll take months for the inflammation and the swelling to very gradually go down. So there's something about Lyme disease that in certain people or certain anatomic sites certainly seems to cause a lot of inflammation, and the symptoms of that infection may not resolve real quickly, even despite, you know, good, effective antibiotic treatment.
I see. And again, we're not going to dwell on this, but then there is some debate out there about how people who have these ongoing symptoms, post Lyme disease symptoms, should deal with these symptoms, and some believe they need even more antibiotics, and that's not going to do anything.
Well, there's a huge controversy. Most physicians practicing in this area, certainly most infectious disease specialists, would strongly agree with and support the treatment guidelines that had been put forth by the Infectious Disease Society of America a few years ago. And those guidelines had got sort of generated a fair amount of backlash and controversy among certain circles of people, you know, with Lyme disease and Lyme disease advocates. They'd even been investigated by the Connecticut Attorney General. Richard Blumenthal had, you know, investigated IDSA regarding those guidelines. So they generated a fair amount of controversy. From an infectious disease sort of physician viewpoint, we would say that the benefits of sort of prolonged ongoing antibiotics are probably very minimal, and certainly we see risks and problems associated with ongoing sort of chronic antibiotic use. Mm-hmm. So in general, we would strongly discourage people from doing that.
We are talking with Dr. David McNamara. He specializes in infectious disease with Gundersen Health System. We're talking about treating Lyme disease and welcoming your questions for him at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org or post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's about 10 minutes before 7 now on this Wednesday, May 14th, talking with our guest physician who specializes in infectious disease, Dr. David McNamara, about Lyme disease and tick-borne illnesses, talking about the signs and symptoms and prevention and treatment of Lyme disease. Have you ever had it? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Let's take a caller. We have Kelly in Minocqua with us. Hello, Kelly.
Yeah, I have a question about anyone who had taken the vaccine, I think, when they were kind of testing it back in the 90s, if they've had any issues, lingering effects, or from that.
You know, That was a little bit before my time, certainly working in infectious disease. But there was a Lyme disease vaccine that had been marketed, I believe, by Merck back in the 1990s. And my understanding is that it was thought to be modestly effective in the trials. And it was withdrawn from the market several years after it was introduced. And the reason the manufacturer gave was ostensibly poor sales. They had certainly run into, you know, a certain amount of controversy about and I think some legal attention about, is the vaccine causing symptoms? But that's not something that I've know a whole lot about. I've certainly never seen anybody who, you know, had symptoms that they thought was from the vaccine.
Yeah.
Our previous guest
was saying that that there was people didn't like the soreness, or, you know, from the injection, but there wasn't anything necessarily beyond that. That they would have to do it yearly, and that the manufacturers, the companies, didn't think it would be profitable.
Wow. And can I ask, this caller, had you had the vaccine?
Yeah.
And what was your experience with it?
Well, I don't remember any, you know, extreme reactions. I don't remember having significant pain. It was late late 90s when I had the series of three injections over like a month. And I had also heard that potentially then someone who had the vaccine would always test positive.
I'm not sure about that. I don't happen to know offhand.
Yeah, but you're not having any lingering effects, Kelly, as far as you know, from that?
As far as I know, I don't. But I've been, my job has me out in the woods all the time, and so I just, if a positive test would always show, I was just wondering how they would determine.
Oh, I see. So do you give a blood test to people, Dr. McNamara, to see if they test positive for Lyme?
So we often do blood testing looking for antibodies to Lyme disease, and that certainly takes a bit of interpretation. It's a two-part test. The first part is what we call an ELISA assay, which is very sensitive, but it's not super accurate. So we get some false, can certainly get some false positives with it. But if the ELISA is positive, then the second step that we would often go to is called a Western blot test, which is much more specific. It's also more expensive and more labor-intensive for a lab to run. And the Western blot test certainly takes some interpretation. The CDC has some interpretive guidelines that physicians and labs use as to whether or not we call a test positive or negative. And I'm not sure offhand what the effects of the Lyme disease vaccine would be on the antibody blood test.
Mm-hmm.
Don't happen to know that. But I know certainly people who have had Lyme disease, they'll have a positive blood test that'll often stay positive for years, often a decade or two. Those antibodies can be very long-lasting in the blood, and that's just saying that the immune system recognizes those Lyme disease bacteria. And having a positive blood test, you know, say from Lyme disease in the past, certainly makes it more challenging and more difficult to try and figure out subsequently if somebody had a reinfection or a new infection. So that's a very challenging situation because we know the blood test may be positive from old Lyme disease the person had previously.
Mm-hmm. Kelly, thank you for the call. Kim in New London is with us now. Hello, Kim.
Hello.
Hi. I know you have talked about this earlier, and I'm not sure if you would have the expertise on this, but I have three very young kids. They're all under the age of three or younger, and we can't treat with prevention. We can't spray them with DEET. Is there any other thing that we can put on them or do to help prevent them from getting bit? My daughter has already been bit, had the Lyme disease, so I'm just trying to be proactive.
Sure, with little kids. Few thoughts is, one is, I'm not a pediatrician, so I don't have a huge amount of expertise in pediatrics, but my understanding is that the American Academy of Pediatrics has issued a statement or believes that you can use DEET, I think, in a concentration of less than 20% on children. And that's sort of my rough understanding on that. I have young kids, too, and we certainly have used insect repellent with DEET on them, you know, like the, you know, family care kind of insect repellent. So we use that. That being said, I think ticks are probably tougher to deter and prevent with, like, insect repellent than are mosquitoes. And our kids are young, and they're active, and they're out of doors. And we certainly pull ticks off of, you know, my two little kids occasionally as well. And the things that we do are to do a really careful tick check after being out of doors. So, you know, if we're out hiking in western Wisconsin, when we come home that night, we'll strip the kids down, get a good look everywhere, and it's not uncommon that we'll find a tiny little deer tick on them. That is a relatively common thing in our region. And so, you know, we do a careful deer tick check. We tend to, like, wash the kids down in a tub. We put some insect repellent on them. But as a parent, I think it's a bit scary. But on the other hand, we want to get outdoors and be active. Yeah. Our kids want to get out. And it's, I think it's a risk living in this region, that we use, you know, some vigilance in that, trying to detect ticks that are on the kids.
And we should do that for the adults, for each other too, right?
You bet. Yeah. You bet. Yep.
All right, let's take Rosemary in Pewaukee next. Hello, Rosemary.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I had two questions. As a person with several family members that have Lyme disease, acute form and chronic, I had two questions. Where are the statistics coming from that would indicate that there is cure or recovery for some of the people who have gone through the antibiotics series that you offer, for example, the orals? Are they following people for years afterwards, for example, to see if they really are better?
I'm sorry, Rosemary, we have only time for that question, as we only have about a minute or so to go. Dr. McNamara?
You know, the statistics in terms of studies sort of saying how effective is the treatment, you know, a lot of it would be from studies that had been in peer-reviewed medical journals and studies of Lyme disease treatment. A lot of our treatment guidelines we're getting through Infectious Disease Society of America guidelines, certainly CDC, certainly, you know, a lot of state departments of health, Wisconsin and Minnesota are tracking epidemiologic statistics. And that, so that's sort of the source of the guidance that we use in terms of trying to come up with effective treatments for this, you know, very common and occasionally really debilitating infection that we see a lot of in our region.
We have to leave it there. Thank you so much for being with us. Dr. David McNamara is with the Gunderson Health System. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.